Okay, we are in the beginning of chapter 13. It is found on page Yud Ches on the top numbers. We're continuing with our explanation of a Beinoni. And we said that a Beinoni never does, says, or thinks anything bad. And the reason why he is not a tzaddik is because he doesn't hate bad things at all. He rather likes them, as a matter of fact. But he's in complete and absolute control and never allows himself, never lets his guard down, and is constantly doing the right thing and never doing the wrong thing. That's the definition of a Beinoni.
Okay.
In this chapter, he's going to answer some of the questions which were posed in chapter 1. And I will reiterate the question as we go through them, seeing that this is 13 chapters later. In the first chapter, he gave a definition of a Beinoni. And he said, quoting a Gemara in Brachas, that tzaddikim yetzer tov shaftim. What's the definition of a tzaddik? Is that the yetzer tov judges. Rishayim, yetzer hara shaftim. In the Rishas, the yetzer hara judges. And then he says, and with a Beinoni, they both judge. And he asks the question, but we know a Beinoni is not a Rasha, and as soon as he listens to his Yetzer Hara, he's automatically a Rasha. So it can't be that a Beinoni is half and half. Sometimes he's listening to this one, sometimes he's laughing listening to that one, because as soon as he's listening to the Yetzer Hara, he's not a Beinoni anymore. So we now understand what does it mean when it says that statement in the Gemara, Peshitav Yitzhara, Diksiv, Ki Yamad Liyamin Yavyain, Laheshia Meshaifte Nafshay. As it says that he stands on the side of the right of the impoverished to save the judgment of his soul. That Hashem helps the person if they want to make the right decision, is what that pasuk is talking about. And of course, it's a different pasuk later. It says, generally speaking, if you'll open yourself up like the size of a pinhole, so then Hashem will open himself up like the gates of the Ulam, which were 60 amos wide. That, and if you'll open yourself up two pinholes wide, then you get two gates of the Ulam, which is now 120. So it's 60 per pinhole, basically. So meaning if you take and you make the first effort, Hashem will take over. But Hashem is not going to start. In other words, Hashem, the expression, God helps those who help themselves, that is very much true. There has to be what's called in the jargon in Isurusa Dilatata. There has to be the person has to initiate the relationship with Hashem. We see this, we are now in those parshias that deal with the construction of the sanctuary in the desert, which was portable. If you look, for example, you have the Aron HaKodesh. The Aron HaKodesh was built to be carried by four Levites. If you'll analyze the structure, you see, how did they carry it? You had these poles which were inserted through gold rings, which had been soldered onto the side of the ark, and it was actually a prohibition that we're never allowed to remove those poles from those rings once they were inserted. But if you think about it, if you know anything about metals, the ark was made out of pure gold. Those poles were cedar which was overlaid in pure gold. They used a pure gold solder. What was inside the ark? Now, aside from the ark itself, because the ark cover was made out of pure gold, and the statues that were on top of them were solid gold, and then inside the ark you had the tablets of the Ten Commandments, which were made out of solid sapphire, and solid sapphire is the second densest material on earth besides diamond. The dimensions of those tablets fit snugly into the box which was 5 feet by 2 feet by 2 feet. So this piece of sapphire, being that sapphire is so dense, probably close to a ton. Wow. So now you have four guys carrying this box. Okay, what do you think? That certainly is a lot for anybody to sort of like pick up a box and carry like a ton of stuff. But if you think further, it's an impossibility. The poles were attached with gold solder. As soon as they went to pick up those poles, what would have happened? They just would have ripped right out. There is no way that you could have picked up a ton of sapphire stone with basically the supports of four gold solderings. Impossible. But what happened is they would put the four Levites. Who were these Levites? These Levites, you got, this is the carrying the ark. This is like hoo-ha-hoo. You have to get the important people. Okay? These are the elders of the tribe of Levi, the Kohos. The point man was Kohos, was Korach. He was the number one man on carrying the altar, or carrying the ark. No slouch. Got a portion named after him, after all. And just to tell you about Korach a little bit, would you lead a rebellion against Moses? No. No. Absolutely not. But he thought he could lead a rebellion against Moses and win. That tells you something about who he was. Okay? Four old men carried this thing, meaning that they didn't carry it at all. It's impossible. The thing carried itself. So if the thing carried itself, why don't they just put the ark cover on and let it float along? Because then everybody would have pointed and said, look, not understanding the principles of superconductivity, they would have said, it's a miracle. God doesn't work that way. What did they each do? They each grabbed onto the pole and said, okay, let's go. And up it went. They had to put their hand on it first. Yeah. And then Hashem said, oh, you got your hand on it already? Good. Now I can make it go. The same thing with the menorah. The menorah was made of a solid block of gold that weighed 600 pounds. And how many people carried that? Two. With one hand, one finger on each side. They put their finger on each side, picked it up, whoop, up it went. Wow. Because Hashem is there to help. Every step of the way, Hashem is there to help. All you got to do is say, okay, I'm starting. This is, you ask a question, how come not so many people win the lottery? You know, people buy these lottery tickets, you know, every week you have, now we have two lotteries, you know, it's just like, you know, like one wasn't enough, I got two, okay? And what are people thinking? They buy a lottery, let's say $100 million lottery. So they're thinking, you know, Hashem, if I'm going to win this lottery, I'm going to give $50 million away to charity. And, you know, I'm not going to give 20%, you know, it says, don't squander more than 20% on charity. I can manage living on $50 million a year. The other $50 million, I'm going to be generous, God. I'm going to give it away to chariot. How well does that work? Well, how many from Jews have won lotteries in this country? Two. One was for $2 million, one was for five. Okay? So, that one doesn't work. If you want to give $50 million to charity, give the $50 million first, and then Hashem will say, oh, look, this guy really means it. He went and got himself $50 million and gave it away to charity. I'm going to give him $100 million. Try doing it that way and see what happens. But this business is, I'm going to win and I'll give. God says, nah, I don't need that. That doesn't turn me on. Like, big whoop. You know, so it says, so Hashem stands at the right hand of the impoverished and helps them. The statement in the Talmud is not that by a Beinoni, the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer Tov rule. God forbid. It says judge. Because were it to be that the Yetzer Hara would dominate in the body of the Beinoni, he wouldn't be a Beinoni. We'd call him a Rasha at that time. What's the Yetzer Hara in the Beinoni? He's a judge. What do judges do? They offer up their opinion. They say, this is what needs to be done. But it's possible that the judge could not be, we don't have to listen to that judge. Why? In Judaism, you can't have his it says. The only Hashem can judge singularly. Everybody else, you need to have somebody else judging. Because as good as a person may be, everybody has ulterior motives. Everybody has self-interests. Not everybody knows everything. So we say, this guy's got to have somebody else judging opposite him. Just to keep him on the straight and narrow. So it's possible this guy's going to say, go for it. And the other one's going to say, wait a minute. Hello, you don't want to do that. Which is what's going on with the Yetzer Hara, Yetzer Tov. Now this would be a court case. You have one judge says guilty. One judge says innocent. What are you going to do now? You get a third judge. You get another judge. The halacha kedivrei machriya. And the opinion is going to follow the third judge.
Yeah.
Third judge is going to say guilty is going to be guilty. The third judge is going to say innocent is going to be innocent. So too it is also that the Yetzer Hara gives its opinion in the left ventricle in the heart, which is where it's staying. And from the brain it goes up to, from the heart it goes up to the brain, and to start to think about whatever piece of advice the Yetzer Hara is giving. And immediately the second judge pipes in, which that's the godly soul, which is in the brain. So right now he's got this intellectual thing going on. Do I think about this? Do I not think about it? Do I follow it? Do I not follow it? That's all intellectual. There's no passion involved there. And from the brain it spreads out to the right side of the heart. And the halacha is like HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who always is going to help the Yetzer Tov if you let it. As it says, were it not for Hashem, you'd never be able to defeat your Yetzer Hara. Why? Is the Yetzer Hara that strong? Well, the Yetzer Hara is pretty strong. But the way it's set up is the Yetzer Hara's got a handicap. He's been in the body for 13 years before the Yetzer Tov. So he's like the one we normally listen to. We got accustomed for the first 13 years of our lives to listening to our Yetzer Hara. And so now all of a sudden the Yetzer Tov is a new guy on the block. So the Yetzer Hara is saying, look at this new punk over here. You're going to listen to him? He'll listen to me. So it says, we're not the fact that Hashem says, follow the Yetzer Tov, will you already? But the Yetzer Hara isn't always going to rear its hairy head and say with a big neon sign, I'm your Yetzer Hara. This is what I want you to do. Mm-hmm. Because if it did, what would you do?
You'd say, the other way.
No, so I'm not going to do that. I'm going the other way. If he's going to put up a sign and says, listen, this is the wrong thing to do, and it's really clear cut, and I want you to do it, he's not going to do it. So the Yetzer Hara has to come in such a way that it looks like it's the right thing to do. And indeed, I think we may have talked about this before, that there are, for example, 53,000 people incarcerated in Michigan that if you ask them, didn't do anything wrong.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we see.
Right.
Of course.
Yeah. Because they figure this is, you know, my, I never thought of this story. My wife
when she was a young woman, was living in New York, and someone organized a women's chaplaincy group to go to Rikers Island. Rikers Island is the county correctional facility for New York City. It's sort of like a holding pen where people go until they get their trials. And it's not exactly what you call the greatest of places, as you can probably imagine. They put it there is because it makes it a lot easier, because you would probably die if you tried to swim across to the mainland, even though it's really not all that far to the mainland, but you'd never make it. Not because there's sharks in the water or anything like that, just because of the nature of the East River. So your skin would probably dissolve off your body first.
Yeah, I was thinking chemical. Yeah.
Anyway, so there she is, and they evidently didn't give her any type of orientation, because one of the first things, if you've ever done any chaplaincy work in prison, one of the first things they tell you is, do not ask this person why they are there. Right. Because first of all, that's none of your business. Second of all, what are you trying to accomplish by finding out? It'll only make them feel bad, and most likely they won't tell you anyway. So don't even bring it up. So she's waiting for all the inmates to come. They got this lady, Esther. Okay? Esther comes down, 70 years old. She's got her hair in curlers. She's got a fuzzy slippers. She's got on a muumuu. She looks like everybody's grandmother.
My goodness, you really want to ask.
So my wife said, what are you doing here? So she said, my son was dating a shiksa and they were going to get married. So I shot the shiksa. And I would do it again.
Oh, okay?
For her, it was a mitzvah. Oh. Her Yetzer Hara told her, it's a mitzvah for you to go do this.
Her Yetzer
Hara. Yeah, she spent the rest of her life in jail. And no, that is not a... I think it's that the guitar player's name. I shot the shiksa. No. It's not what it is.
Well, Marley originally. Bob Marley and then Eric Clapton.
Eric Clapton, that's what it's there, but Eric Clapton, yeah. So, no, it's not a Clapton song. So, the Clapton was Jewish, right? His real name was Kaufman, right? No. Anyway, so, because people have this way of... Now, it doesn't have to be such a bad thing. It could very well be that there's a standard story that involves Meir Premishlam. Meir Premishlam was a Rebbe around the same time as the Tzemach Tzedek in the 1850s, 1860s, in the city of Premishlam, which is central Poland. He could not go to sleep if there was money in the house. He would lie down in bed, and his eyes would stay awake, and he'd say, there must be money in the house. And he would go and find the money, and then go find somebody to give it to. Okay? Needless to say, they were not exactly what you would refer to as the most opulent of individuals in the city. Going to sleep, he never had any money. He never had any money. By the end of the day, there was no money in the house. Why do you do this? Because it says in the Talmud that if a person borrows money, you can't go to him right away and claim, hey, I want the money back right now. You made a certain time, because Stam Halvah Shloshim Yoim, if you didn't lay down any terms, so we expect the money to be paid back in 30 days. So why can't we expect them to give the money right away? Is because Mamayin Lahaitzois Nitna. Money is given to pay off debts. Why do people need money? To go buy things. Come in. So, somebody comes in and visits him. Steve, I think you heard this story about Meir Premishlam. Someone comes to visit him, asks his advice, and thanks you very much, and he gives this Meir Premishlam 300 rubles, which is an incredible sum of money. We're talking about how the Yetzirah comes to a person.
Ah, uh-huh, very good.
Okay. The next person who came in was a farm yokel, and he was crying. He's got 5 daughters, and they're all marriageable age, and he doesn't have any money, and he's got debts up the wazoo, and he doesn't know what he's going to do. And so Meir says, how much money do you need? And he says, I need 300 rubles. So he told him, come back in an hour. An hour went by, guy comes back, he opens up the drawer, hands him the 300 rubles. Says, have a nice day. So his son, who was a Mashareth, said, I don't understand something. Keep the money. I knew you were not going to keep the money. Even though it could have paid for all of our bills and debts and we would have had what to live over, we would have had some, life would have been a little easier, 300 rubles. I knew you weren't going to keep it. But what'd you make the guy come back in an hour for? So he said it's like this. As soon as the person said, he was one of these people who's quite seriously thought very little of himself. He never used the word I. He always referred to himself in third person. Says, as soon as this person came in and gave 300 rubles, and then the next person comes in and says, I need 300 rubles. So Meir thought, when does Meir ever have 300 rubles? Of course, this person gets the 300 rubles. But then immediately a thought came into Meir's head. Why should this guy get all 300 rubles? Give 30 rubles to 10 families. They'll be able to live a month. Give 10 rubles to 30 families. They'll be able to live a week. One of these ideas is Yetzer Tov. The other two ideas are Yetzahara. They all sound perfectly wonderful ideas, but two of them are wrong. It's that black and white. One of them is the right thing to do. The other two things are absolutely 100% wrong. How are you going to figure it out? So he said, I need an hour to sort this one out. When he came back, he said, what was his rationale? That since he had his first impulse was to give the money, if you'd be doing the wrong thing, the Yetzer Hara wouldn't bother you. The Yetzer Hara only bothers you when you're doing the right thing, and its job is to stop you from doing the right thing. So if he'd be doing the wrong thing, the Yetzer Hara would never be bothering us. Like, you know, for example, that if you've got 20 minutes to daven shacharis, you never catch yourself fantasizing when you're doing a 20-minute shacharis.
Right.
Your mind is not wandering when you're doing a 20-minute shacharis. Because the Yetzer Hara says, why should I waste my time? He's doing a bad enough job by himself.
Exactly.
I don't have to bother him.
Yeah,
now what happens? The person gets all excited. He's got some time. He's going to sit down. He's going to start thinking. He's going to sit there with an English and do with the two fingers whatever he's going to do. He's going to focus on his davening over here. Now all of a sudden he's imagining what would be if he was doing the downhill competition in the Olympic ski jumping. There he is, on the slopes. Okay? Why? Because the Yetzer Hara has got to get him to stop doing something good. So the general rule is if you're about to do something good, and then suddenly a better thought comes into your mind...
It ain't.
It's not.
Yeah.
It's not. Stick with the good thing to begin with.
Well, stick with plan A.
That's what we mean when we say that Hashem helps a person out.
We need some help then. Because there's a lot of times when you think the second thought is a better idea.
Now, if you would have given 30 people 10 rubles, would you have gotten the mitzvah of giving tzedakah?
Sure, of course.
Yeah, you sure would have.
Of course. You
would. To 30 different people. And they would have been very happy for you. For it. Very, you know.
Sure, of course.
But it was the wrong. It was absolutely the wrong thing to do.
Right.
The Ha'ezer is the last word on the line that we're up to. The Ha'ezer.
Okay, good.
And the help. Hu Ha'or Shemeya Or Hashem Al Nafshei Shelekis. Well, how does Hashem help a person? It says that Hashem only, the people are only able to vanquish the Yetzer Hara because Hashem's helping them. Give them a little impetus, a little push. What's the push? The push is his soul gets a little bit of a charge that says, okay, your godly soul can handle this. Let's go. Charge. Lihiyeis la yisrin shlita al sichlas haksil v'hayetzahara, in order that he should be able to rule over the foolishness of this fool, the Yetzahara. Ki yisrin ha'or min ha'choshech hanal, as the advantage of light coming from darkness, as we mentioned in chapter 12. Acher, but you think it's so easy? Guy's going to say, no, that's the Yetzahara. I'm not thinking about that now. Mm-hmm. The Yetzahara is going to say, oh, shucks, I lost that one. I'm going home.
Yeah, that's what he
right. Since it is that the evil that's in the left ventricle in the Benini is still at the strength like the day he was born. To desire all kinds of physical pleasures of this world, it never loses its existence. So you could think, you have he brought into before in chapter 10 different levels of bittul, of nullification of the good to the evil, etc. Whether it's nullified in 60 or in 1,000 or 10,000, brought in those various different numbers. There is a rule that says, and as far as kashrus goes, okay, you have three identical loaves of bread. For all you can tell, that they're made exactly the same way. This is not going to work. No, it's not bread. Bread's not a good example because it's a derish of a minion. What would be something lach? You've got 2 pounds of flour, regular, everyday, normal flour, and 1 pound of flour, which was truma,
okay,
for example. Okay? And they all got mixed up. Okay? There's no way you're going to separate them.
You mean the bags got dumped and they're all mixed together?
They're all mixed together. You got 3 pounds of flour now.
You have 3 pounds of flour now.
Yeah. Truma is actually a bad example because with truma you need 5, 2, 1, and 200. What's a good example? Shemitah. You got a pound of Shemitah flour. I'm going to find a good example for this. You got a pound of Shemitah flour and 2 pounds of regular flour. They get mixed all up. So the deal is that lach b'lach, excuse me, yavish v'yavish is batel b'reif. If you've got two dry ingredients that are mixed together, one of them kosher, one of them not kosher, all you need is majority kosher for it to be kosher. You don't need batel b'shishim. Batel b'shishim is only if they're both wet ingredients.
Okay.
So you've got two dry ingredients mixed together. So you need 51% kosher and the whole thing's kosher. Okay, so here it is, you have the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer Tov. And they're mixed together inside the body.
Mm-hmm.
So you really can't tell the difference what's one from the other. You can't pull them apart. And it's basically, they're made out of the same material.
Mm.
So you'd think that as long as I'm like 51% Yetzer Tov, I'm doing okay, because the rest is going to get bottle. It doesn't work that way. not this way, because
I wish.
Right. Who says the Yetzirah is a dry ingredient?
Yeah. Might make me a dry ingredient, but
Right. It's not nullified in its minuteness compared to the Tov. V'lai nidcha b'mimkayim ha'kalal. The Yetzer never gets pushed away. Because, yeah, for example, if you have pepper, which was used in an idolatrous service, somebody went to India, they went, brought you back the best Indian pepper. And it just so happens that this pepper, before they sell it, was put on an altar, and then they sweep it off and put it in these little boxes, and they can sell it more for in India because it says, was put on the altar of so-and-so.
Right.
Okay? You're not allowed any benefit from that pepper whatsoever.
Right.
What happens? Somebody now takes that pepper, puts it into a pepper grinder, gives a click on an entire pot of stew. The whole thing's no good.
Yeah, it's history.
Because you can taste the pepper. However little you're going to put in there, you can taste the pepper. Mm-hmm. So the pepper is usur b'mashahu. That's what the Yetzer Hara is more like. The pepper, the Yetzer Hara is more like a pepper, like black pepper, than it would be like, than say, dry flour.
Right. That's just kind of like pepper on your pancakes, guys. It's just doesn't matter how little it is, it just ruins them.
Is that one of those Texas expressions?
Yeah, that's not the kind of Texas. I'm sorry.
Very good.
Pepper on the pancakes. Okay.
Tabasco. Are you sure that's not Texas?
I've had jalapeno pancakes. They're not bad.
Tabasco. You ever had jalapeno jelly?
Yeah. Yeah. I made habanero jelly. It was really quite good, actually.
Yeah.
Rak, only, this, the Yetzer Hara is there. It's still burning. Rak, she'ein lo shlitamam shalali hispasha be'evor yaguf. Only thing is it doesn't have the dominion to rule over and spread out into the limbs of the body. Because Hashem is standing at the right side of the impoverished, and is helping and illuminating the godly soul. Were it not for Hashem, what Hashem is doing basically at this point is basically counteracting the taste of the pepper. Which you're going to need some sort of a, some kind of a something. When you're talking physical terminology, to counteract pepper, you need some sort of an unpepper chemical. Which I don't even know if such a thing exists.
Not really, no. Put a little more honey on it, but it just...
Yeah, it's just going to still... The pepper's still going to be there.
Yeah.
Okay, so Hashem basically is like standing there unpeppering it as your Yetzer Hara is peppering it. Okay, you're doing what you're standing there going with the pepper grinder, and Hashem's standing there underneath catching it, making sure the pepper doesn't go in.
Yeah, that's for sure.
You know, that's the help that the Nefesh HaLakis gets. Lachain Nikra Kirasha is the answer to the second question. That's why it says when Mashbi V'haya Be'enecha Kirasha. So the whole thing that Tanya worked, the first question that he asks is, even if the whole world says that you're a tzaddik, haya be'einecha kirasha, you should be in your own eyes like a wicked person.
Right.
It doesn't say consider yourself to be a Russia. It says like a Russia.
Right.
Everybody's coming around and trumpeting your goodwill and your good accomplishments and saying this person's a tzaddik. So the first thing you're not supposed to do is say, you know, they're right. Because we know anybody who pats themselves on the back and says, I'm a tzaddik, we know one thing for sure about them is that they are not. So, but he says you have to consider yourself like a Russia. What does it mean, like a Russia? Not a Russia. He should make himself, at least consider himself to be like, I'm a Beinoni. That's what Rava did. Rava considered himself, he said, like, for example, I'm a Beinoni. You want to call me a tzaddik? I'm not a tzaddik. What is a tzaddik? A tzaddik is something, it's a level, an accomplishment. I know I don't do anything wrong, say anything wrong, or think anything wrong. So I must be a Beinoni. And any time a thought would might enter into my head, which at that point was Rava, it never even entered into his head, they're gone already. I'm pushing them out. So that's why he said, I'm a Beni. And that's what the person who is, even if the whole world says that you're a tzaddik, should say, nah, I'm not a Beni. I'm not a tzaddik, I'm a Beni. Okay? And we say, halavai. you should only be a Beni,
yeah,
buddy.
Yeah.
The Laila Hamila Eila. Yeah. And you shouldn't believe the world that says, Sha'im Sharasha Bain is Batal Gaviatov. They say this guy's got no evil in him whatsoever. Mm. She says, Madrig is tzaddik, because that's what a tzaddik is. Mm-hmm. So, how does the world know who's a tzaddik, who's not a tzaddik? Bottom line, how could we know?
Yeah, it's impossible.
We don't know who's a tzaddik. And if you knew
we
somebody.
Know who's not.
That we for sure do. If we knew somebody was a tzaddik,
yeah.
How would it help?
It wouldn't.
How would that knowledge help us even? Okay? And if a person thought that they were a tzaddik, you know, I've kind of been thinking lately, I think I must be a tzaddik. Okay? I mean, even if the guy's being sincere and he's like, you know, I don't speak anything wrong, I don't do anything wrong, I'm not thinking anything wrong, have I perhaps reached the level of tzaddik? Well, I'm kind of thinking that tzaddik never even has that conversation with himself.
They're right, yeah.
Because he doesn't have any time to stop and start evaluating, well, am I this or am I that? Have I achieved the level of Beinoni yet?
Right.
Okay, people don't have those kind of conversations.
Right.
You know, so, did the Lubavitcher Rebbe know that he was the Lubavitcher Rebbe? Yeah. Did he ever refer to himself as the tzaddik of the generation? No. Did he refer to his father-in-law as the tzaddik of the generation? Yeah. You could do that. You could say, my father-in-law was the tzaddik of the generation.
Right.
And we could likewise say, oh, the Rebbe must be the tzaddik of the generation. Shizumacher, Elayiya Be'enav, it should be Ki'ilu Mahusvat Musa Shalarahu Bataku Varasai. A person should consider it that the evil which is in his heart, here we just turn the page, is in its full strength. Bechalos Mali Bechaldosa, just the same way it was the day that he was born. And it hasn't been dislodged the least iota. As time goes on and we get more accustomed to our Yetzer Hara, we get better at listening to it. Comes up with better claims. You know how much of a person is going to work on themselves and say, you know, I don't want to listen to my Yetzer Hara anymore. Okay, I'm going to really focus and I'm going to really try. And the Yetzer Hara is going to say, oh, I'm in big trouble, I'm going to sleep, bye. No, the Yetzer Hara is going to say, what are you talking about? You and me, we're good buddies. Yeah. You've been listening to me all this time, all these years. You're just going to kick me out like that? Yeah. It's not going to happen. I'm not going to go away. So you shouldn't think that the evil's gone. He's not even thinking anything wrong. But he can't ever let himself down and say, well, let's just see what happens if... A person should never test themselves. We know that from David HaMelech. David HaMelech, the whole problem that David HaMelech gotten with Bathsheba was because he was talking with God and he said, you know, God, I think I'm ready for a test. And God said, don't go there. Don't even think about such a thing. And he said, no, I want to see what my mettle is. I really want to know how to do this. I want to know where I'm up to. Okay? I want to test. And Almighty really tried talking him out of it.
The amazing thing is he's on a level to have the conversation.
Okay, good. Yeah, but he should have listened.
And then... You know,
if I'm talking to God, yeah, and I say, God, I think I really want something, and God says to me, I don't think it's the best idea.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to say, okay, you win. I'm trusting you.
Uh-huh.
Okay? All right. And God told him even what the test is going to be.
There is a Hasidic Yetzer Hara.
Yeah. Rabbi Rishab talks about that. What's a Chassidish Yetzirah? It's 10 o'clock. Davening starts at 10 o'clock in North Oak Park. Mm-hmm. And what do you want to do? You want to take out a Lakuti Torah, a Torah Or, and you want to learn some Chassidic insight into the Parsha. Mm-hmm. It'll make you feel really good when you get to davening. So that way you're not davening now. You're pushing off your davening. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to learn Lakuti Torah, it should have been at 8 o'clock in the morning, not 10 o'clock.
Right.
10 o'clock in the morning is the time for davening.
Or at 10 o'clock, you know, well, I really needed to go to mikveh, so I'll go to mikveh and come back.
You know, anything that's going to take a person away from what they're supposed to be doing.
Of course, the minyan is 9. They need 10 to be on time. But
right.
You know.
Okay. Mm. So anything that's going to take a person away from what right. they're supposed to be doing,
right.
it could come, as the expression is, with white socks and short pants, your Yetzirah could come.
Yes, indeed.
You know the analogy, yeah? Short pants and white socks.
No, oh, yeah. For a second, I was like,
okay. If my Yetzirah came to me with knickers and short and white socks, I know there was something wrong.
Yeah, well,
so. No, I'm not going there. That's not how it's happening, sorry.
Yeah.
Shinal doesn't turn me on there, sir.
Right, yeah.
Okay.
How about a big beard and big floppy head?
There you go. Okay. I'm not saying I don't have a Yetzirah. Where are we? It gets strong. The thing is, the Yetzirah gets stronger the course of time because he's using it with eating and drinking and shara and yoni or lamazeh. Okay? Every time he eats something, the Yetzirah gets involved. Every time he's turning around, the Yetzirah is right there. Do it my way. Even if you have a person who's sitting day and night and he's learning for the sake of the Torah, this is no proof that the evil has been dislodged. And he says later in chapter 15, it could be that this person just has a nature that he likes to sit and learn, and he's going to sit and learn for 15 hours a day. And it's just for him the most natural thing to do.
Right.
Okay. He talks later on in chapter, the end of chapter 39. He says it could be, let's say a person is learning, he's sitting a whole day and he's learning.
Mm.
And you better just run out. He's doing it that everybody should say what a great guy he is. Look at this guy. He sits and he learns 15 hours a day. And he's sitting and learning 15 hours a day. He's not joking. Okay, there's a joke that Hasidim tell of a guy who got married and he was learning for the cat. What does it mean? His shver said, I will keep you... on the books, you can sit and learn,
mm-hmm.
provided that you're sitting and learning.
Right.
So what happens, one time he heard, he's sitting, he has his room in an attic, and he hears his mother-in-law come up, and she's kind of like, you know, on the door, kind of gives a little look in, and he sees it's, you know, it's his mother-in-law, so he takes out the book, and he starts learning. What happens after that, the mother-in-law is very happy. The cat comes up now and starts leaning against the door, scratching against the door. So he thinks it's the mother-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
So every time the cat comes and rubs up against the door, he starts learning. So this guy's learning for the cat. Okay?
We should all have one.
Right, so...
You got your dove.
Yeah.
So if a person's learning for the wrong reason, the people should say to themselves, wow, that guy's really great. Look, he sits and learns 15 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what that makes the guy's day. Yeah, recognition. The Alter Rebbe says, not in chapter 40, but later on, one of the most, the greatest expression of Talmudic exegesis, it would have been better that his afterbirth would have fallen over his face. How's that one for...
That's pretty strong.
That's a pretty heavy statement.
He uses it for that, and he uses it a person who learns with no intention of doing. Same type of thing. A person just learning for it. It's an intellectual exercise. He says, Nayash Yahapach Lilasal Panav, it'd be better that his afterbirth would have fallen over on his face. So you got this guy, he's sitting and he's learning. He's learning for the right reason. He's really in the groove. He's cooking. He's doing all eight cylinders. Everything's firing perfectly. He's got no ulterior motive involved whatsoever. This is no proof that he got rid of the evil. It could very well be that the essence and being of his Yetzer Hara is still right there in his left ventricle. There is a story told about the Rambam, and to me this story has always sounded like a fairy tale. And I've heard it from many people, respectable people, in many circumstances. And it may even, I think I saw it written down. But it still, to me, sounds like a fairy tale.
Fair enough.
But the point of the story is applicable. There were some people, the Rambam was an advisor for the Caliph in Rush in Egypt. He was his doctor, he was his advisor. And people who were upset that a Jew should have such an ear to the Caliph really were quite perturbed by the Rambam's place. Mm-hmm. They wanted to get the Rambam back. They wanted to get him out of the way. Mm-hmm. So they said, we will challenge you to a test. If you win, you get to do with us anything you want. If we win, we're driving you out of town. I said, fine. So he says, we bet that we can teach cats how to be waiters. I said, fine.
Yeah.
And how long is this going to take? You've heard this story?
Go ahead, it's good.
You heard this one?
Go ahead, yeah.
It's going to take how long? It's going to take a month, 2 months, 6 months, whatever it's going to take. So they have this whole ball. And they have it announced on the invitation that the waiters will be cats. Which is why this sounds like to me like a fairy tale. Because you can't train a cat to do anything. Cats cats have owners, not owners have cats.
Right, exactly.
Yes, so you're just there to supply their needs.
Uh-huh.
You don't have them.
No.
So the big day comes. And the cats are walking on two legs, on their hind legs, and they're carrying in stuff, and they're bringing out stuff, they're busing tables and bringing stuff in. And everybody, these advisors saying, Mr. Rambam, you're going to have to be packing your bags. Rambam said, not so fast. In the middle of this whole party, like in the middle of the serving of the main course, so the Rambam takes out of his pocket a small box, and he opens it up and he lets out a mouse. And the mouse scurries away from the table, and all the cats fly into, out of drop all the stuff, they fly over the tables, they're all going to chase after that mouse. Mm-hmm. Okay, whether the story is true or not, as a parable it works very well. Because what we do, and it's quite commemorable, if we can actually get off our four legs and actually do things so etiquette is to serve a table in some sort of a spiritual avoda. Because the fact that we can get up and go to shul and daven a shacharis every day, and especially on a Shabbos morning when you don't have a, when you have a day off and you're thinking to yourself, my one day I could sleep in, and there you are at 9 o'clock in the morning, you're in shul. So you're thinking, this is, you know, I've changed myself. This is... what happens when they pull out the proverbial mouse? Mm-hmm. I remember the first time I heard of Rema Lipsker tell this story, somebody had a made a l'chaim, a chosin, he got engaged, one of the bachurim in the yeshiva. And the l'chaim was in somebody's house in Teaneck, New Jersey. And it was on a Sunday afternoon, and there was a football game on the TV. And three quarters of the buck room watching the football game. So when it came time for the ask Rabbi Lipscomb, please speak. So everybody came in, and he said, so you guys have been in yeshiva for 2-3 years, and you're working on yourselves, and you're just a bunch of cats. As soon as they pull the mice out, the TV comes on, voila, you're back chasing, you're on all fours again. Okay, so not that a person should look and see, well, I mean, it says that if a person, how does a person know that they've done tshuva? It says if you find yourself in the same circumstances as when the person did something wrong, and now he's able to control himself and say, no, I'm not interested in doing that. That's an indication that his tshuva is complete. So what does that mean? A person should say, I want to go see if my tshuva is complete. So therefore, I'm going to go put myself back in that situation and see if I don't do it. You're asking for trouble. Big time.
Because it comes to you anyway.
Because it says in the Gemara, if a person finds himself in that situation, yeah. Not a person put himself into that situation.
Yeah.
I look for a good place to stop. Rashi Levusha, but only his garments. Which are the thought, speech, and action of the animal soul. Do not enclose themselves in the brain, the mouth, the hands, and all the rest of the body parts. Because Hashem gave dominion to the godly soul that the brain should rule over the heart. She's already now quoted already, this is the third time in 2 chapters. That's why it is that the godly soul now, which is in the brain, rules over the whole entire body. That it should be, that the body should be a vessel, a vehicle for conveying the three garments of the godly soul. So that the body is only doing, saying, and thinking Torah and mitzvahs. But the essence and being of the godly soul is not ruling over the nefesh ha-bahamis totally. The only time it is doing it is at prepared times, like we talked about in the last chapter, like for example, the time of Davnik Yitzibo. This just keeps going, it's one long sentence. So we're going to stop here and we'll pick it up next week.
Probably next week.
To be continued.
Regular week.
Regular.